This is tape one, side one, of an oral history interview of Dr. Maxwell Robinson in his home on January 24, 2001. Dr. Robinson, I know from materials I've read that you were born May 26, 1920 in Nova Scotia. Would you tell me something about your parents and your childhood?
Certainly. My birthplace was a very small village called Lakeville in Kings County, Nova Scotia. My father ran the general store there. It was a very short walk from that area over to the schoolhouse. It was a two-room schoolhouse. Six grades in one room and six in another room. Actually, I look back on my early schooling as a fascinating experience. Being in the same classroom with six grades has an amazing advantage. It gives you a chance to review what you had the year before and to get a taste of what's coming up next year. I should say my mother was a school teacher early on and instilled in my sister and myself a strong attachment to a good education. Because of her influence and the school system at the time, I don't remember this, but I was told I took the first four grades in 2 years. Somewhere along about 1927 or 28, my parents moved to a farm. Dad had found that his generous nature did not make the general store an economic and viable situation. There were too many people who in need, who needed flour or sugar or kerosene or something, and he decided to try farming. On the farm, we had no electricity, no telephone in those days, but we didn't feel deprived. Along about grade six, I think primarily because of my mother's influence, we moved to a town Kentville, population then about 5,000, and I think still today about the same. But in that town they had a much broader educational system, since they covered the whole county, and so there was a grade school, a junior high school, and a high school. I went into grade six, I think, when we moved to that town, and progressed up through junior high. Just a vague recollection. Because of my age and stature at the time, I do remember I was the smallest boy in every class. I know my parents kept me back one grade, probably grade 7 or 8, because, well, I was I don't know what the problem was, but it could have either been my age or the classes, or anyway, it was a relief to get slip back a bit. By high school, we had a, you know, one grade to a room, which was a big event. And it was a wonderful high school. I have very fond memories of my chemistry teacher there, Wallace Bartow, and my math teacher particularly, who was Walter Bowers. My sister, who still lives in Halifax, says she sees Walter Bowers, or has seen him in recent years, and he still asks about me. So I had a wonderful relationship with that man.
How many were in your high school class?
I have the high school class right here. I just looked it up. I would guess there may have been about 25.
That's the number that was in my high school class.
Is that right? Well, good for you. I just looked at the high school yearbook and read with glee Maxwell Ivan Robinson, "All great men are not dead yet." And then I'm going to take up my studies next year at Acadia University, which I did. In those days, if you had passed the exams at Kings County Academy with a certain average, you did not have to take the provincial exams, which was always a relief. Also, if you passed through grade 12, you could go into college as a sophomore, which was not a relief. I went into Acadia University as a freshie soph to save money, because it was during the Depression and times were very difficult. One of my most traumatic experiences as a freshie soph was I started Calculus 2 without ever having Calculus 1. So it took a lot of catch up to get up to speed. But at Acadia, I had excellent chemistry professors. My major organic professor was Professor Chet Small, a Newfoundlander, but an excellent professor.
When you went to Acadia University, had you already decided that chemistry was your choice of major, or did that develop while you were at the university?
Yes, I had decided in high school. Somewhere along the line, I do remember back in grade 9 that I had written an assigned topic, "Who do you want to be?" And I said I wanted to be a medical doctor up in grade 9. Somewhere along the line, that switched over to chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time I went to university, I knew chemistry was a pathway that I wanted to proceed on. By 1940, I got a bachelor's degree in chemistry and stayed one more year to get a bachelor's degree with honors in chemistry. That gave me 4 years at Acadia University.
What was the distinction between the two degrees at Acadia at that time?
That you've taken a certain number of courses in your major topic, which I had not had a time to do in 3 years. So that was also, in addition, I picked up a major in mathematics along the line. From Acadia, I went to University of Toronto in the fall of 41, and my major professor there was Professor George F. Wright, who was a strict taskmaster. I can have some comments off the record about George F. Wright. But he did run a micromanaged research group. And of the 10 students in graduate school there with me, two had nervous breakdowns. Mm-hmm. It was a very rigorous situation.
I remember reading papers by George F. Wright back in the 50s, but I didn't know that aspect of his research direction.
I just received from the University of Toronto one of their periodicals in which one of his students wrote up his recollections of times with George F. Wright, which I have here if you care to read it. Anyway, it was a rigorous and uncomfortable environment for me. But fortunately, I was very successful in my research program there. It was during the war, and we were working on explosives, which is an interesting time in a way. We were working on synthesis of RDX, which was ended up being the propellant in the atom bomb. And one of the things we didn't understand why we were testing this, but I later at Los Alamos I did go to their archives and saw some of the. I go back a bit. We were testing the frissons of RDX in an armory on the weekend. And there were shake charges that when the explosive detonated, it blew a hole through a steel plate, and we didn't know why we were doing this, but we later, many, many years later, we found out why. But my major thesis was on the synthesis of methylene dinitramine, which was very successful. In fact, it was considered as a for further developmental work. I was told not to talk about it, and I guess I may be still under the same restriction because I haven't talked about it. But I have my thesis here. From Toronto, I was interviewed by Canadian Industry Limited and went to work at their research lab in Belleuil, Quebec, and worked there until 1943 when I joined the Royal Canadian Air Force. And as I went into pilot training, which I never did finish, because by the time I got further along in the program, they decided that the war was progressing favorably. They didn't need any more pilots. So I back on my honeymoon with Gene, as we got off the train in Nova Scotia, the MPs were there to greet me with a telegram to report back at once, which I ignored for a couple of days till they sent another telegram saying you're being reassigned to something other than pilot. You could be navigator, flight engineer, bombardier, air gunner, or discharge. So the latter was sort of appealing. So we went back to Montreal for discharge.
And that's what did happen. You got discharged.
I got discharged. Went back to CIL for a short time and decided that if I was really going to excel in research, I needed to go back to school.
Do you remember what particularly prompted that line of thought?
I don't think there was any one situation, but I was in a research lab in which there were PhDs, master's degrees, and bachelor's degrees people. And I could tell that the PhDs had a better understanding and probably capability So I said, if I'm going to do this, I better do it right. Even though it was going to be a tough thing to do, to go back to graduate school. So in late 45, I think, I wrote to a number of universities that had ads in CNE News. And of course, with the big influx of GIs back to school at that time, there was a big demand for graduate assistants. And while I heard from several of these places, Purdue University said, yes, we'd like you to come and we can guarantee you housing. That basically was the thing that tipped my decision to go to Purdue. So in the fall of 46, I went to Purdue, but two or three days before I was to leave, they sent another telegram saying the housing was not ready. So I had to leave my wife and child behind with her folks in Montreal, which was a traumatic time in our lives, and head off to Purdue. And with a tremendous influx, and it was an exciting time. I just relished the time. I remember vividly the first day in the big assembly hall. They had crowded 5,000 freshman chemists in there, and we were, I think, about 60 graduate assistants and 8 chemistry professors. And this is what we're going to do. Classes are going to start 7 o'clock in the morning. Lectures. Professor will lecture to 800 or so, and then another 800, and so on. One day a week, new graduate assistants will take over for 2 other lectures and a lab and explain what the professor said in his lecture, which is what we did. But it was a wonderful experience. We had to learn the chemistry that the professor was acknowledging, and I look on that as a wonderful part of my education. I don't think it was planned that way, but being a graduate assistant had some real pluses. My major professors at Purdue were Professor Henry Haas and E.T. McBee. Henry Haas was head of the chemistry department, and partway through my time there, he went to take a job in industry. Fortunately for me, I had a backup in Earl McBee, so I didn't have to switch major professors, which probably would have caused me to take another research program and more time, which I was very reluctant to do. My major thesis was on the vapor phase nitration of 111 trifluoropropane. And I found some good chemistry there and had a satisfactory thesis, and Jean typed my thesis for me. I've got to give a little talk here in Wilmington, and I'm going to acknowledge that Jean helped me put me through graduate school at Purdue and got the then recognized but unaccredited degree PhD, putting husbands through, which is what she did. At Purdue, I was interviewed by a number of corporations and went to visit some of them. DuPont in Wilmington was my prime look, looked like the best situation to do research that I saw.
Did you apply or hear from any of the Canadian industries at that time?
No, I did not apply.
You had already decided to stay put.
Well, basically, I should go back a little bit. Canadian Industries Limited, at the time I worked there, was jointly owned by ICI and the DuPont Company. And DuPont Wilmington, when I interviewed, said that there was a good chance they would be able to give me credit for my CIL and Air Force time, which was 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an added incentive. Anyway, we decided to come to Wilmington, Delaware, and came here in 1949. Housing was still in shortage, but we did find a rental house in the suburbs, which was a tremendous blessing from the one-room apartment we've been living in for 3 years.
To interrupt a moment, in terms of housing, had the university ever been able to fulfill the promise of housing?
Yes, to a degree. Not comfortable housing. Shortly after I arrived at Purdue in September, in about a month, they said because of there were so many married graduate assistants, they were going to open up the Purdue Memorial Union Building, which is like a motel. But it was a very majestic structure in the middle of the campus, and we would have one motel room per family. And so all of us graduate assistants with families crowded into this facility, and it was, and we couldn't afford to eat in the restaurants. So we sat up, we had a motel room with a shower. We sat up in the shower, a table and a hot plate and a pressure cooker, and that's what we subsisted on. And there was no refrigerator. We bought food every day as we needed. It was another tough experience, but we were all in the same boat. And housing on campus was even worse. I mean, the people living in garages and unheated attics, so we actually had heat and hot water, so we were semi-privileged in our one room.
Then you got to Wilmington and
yes, we had
found the housing not all together.
A whole house, but no furniture. So we sat on the stairs and slept on the floor for a while. But anyway, it was a new life. I joined the ammonia department. Was a bench chemist right down in 269 building on the Brandywine River, actually about 100 yards from the Carruthers lab, where Wallace Carruthers made his tremendous contributions to early polymer chemistry. And as I look back a little bit on my history, I should go back a little bit to 1939, when I was a senior majoring in chemistry at Acadia. I went to the World's Fair in New York, to the DuPont Pavilion there, and saw for the first time the new miracle fiber nylon. And the publicity there was made from coal, air, and water. And I said, you know, that's a lot of hype. Because a lot of chemistry and engineering and commercial commitment have been made to bring that into reality. And I think DuPont's statement at the time really was that you can do some real miracles with chemistry and science, which is what happened with nylon. Anyway, 10 years later, I had no idea I'd be working within 100 yards of the Carruthers laboratory and have the opportunity to work in the polymer field. I was at the right place at the right time with the right people. I was in exploratory research section of the old ammonia department, which became polychemicals department that same year, later on that same year. And while I had been in the ammonia department, I'd been working on chemicals. The emphasis switched rapidly to polymer chemistry. And basically, in Gresham's, Frank Gresham was head of the exploratory research section. His agenda, I think, was to see what you can do to find new polymers for our plastics business. At that time, we were, I think, had major plastics in nylon resins, polyethylene resins, methacrylates, and Teflon. In Gresham's group, as a bench chemist, I was assigned early on the program to look for a polyimide. We had a good business in the polyamide field with nylon resins, but the hexamethylene diamine portion of that polyamide was a very expensive portion of that polymer, and it was thought that if we could by any means make a polyimide from a monoamine, it might result in very significant cost savings. So in the lab, I tried many different ways to make a high molecular weight polyamide from a monoamine, and most of those reactions ended up with too many side reactions, so I never did make anything of significant molecular weight.
Those would be necessarily branched polymers in the sense of the hydrocarbon tail from the monoamine would be.
It could be an aliphatic or an aromatic monoamine. Anyway, I did make low molecular weight polymers, but nothing of any significant. And I don't remember the details of this, but I decided to look a little bit outside the box and not restrict my studies or experiments to just monoamines. And I had looked in the literature on stable imides, and I found that pyromolidy imide was a very stable chemical. So fortunately, pyromolytic anhydride was available from oxidation of durian. So I tried to make a polymer from pyromolytic dianhydride and a diamine and ended up with an infusible mass. But at least it did give an infusible mass. By 1952, in fact, I've just gone back to review my lab notebooks. I made a high molecular weight polyamide from a long chain diamine, and it did have some gel in it. so it wasn't completely linear, but I modified the process and was able to make a good high molecular weight polyimide for the first time. We got interesting properties of it. It had very high melting characteristics. It had good electrical properties, and it was exciting. Anyway, probably as a result of that breakthrough, I got promoted to being a supervisor, and Walt Edwards was the man who was assigned to my group to continue the work on polyimides.
Was the work you did on polyimides successfully ever commercialized?
Yes.
What was the polymer named?
Well, the definitive structure changed over my initial one, the polyimides made by DuPont today. Breakthrough in making attractive polyimides was brought to the attention of other departments, and they came to see how we made this polymer, and I know in the polychemicals department it was advanced to a stage where it was the development called polymer E for electrical, probably. In the film department, there was strong interest there. I know we talked to a man by the name of Cy Shrew, who I think took over the initiative to see what utility the polyimide structure would have for the film department's uses. Textile fibers early on displayed some interest, but I don't think it ever reached any significant developmental effort in fibers. After the initial success with polyimides, I went to the library and I looked up other heterocyclic ring structures, model compounds, and I found good stable ring structures in polybenzoxazoles and polybenzimidazoles. I wrote this up as a potential project for the exploratory section, and we assigned a man by the name of Keith Breaker, and Keith was in my group, and he made for the first time both a stable plastic high molecular weight polybenzimidazole and a polybenzoxazole. Keith and I have the initial polymers on each of those two classes. Incidentally, the chemical literature shows that those early patents were recognized as the first patents in the polyimides, polybenzoxazole, polybenzimidazole. I just went to a site on the internet recently when I heard about this interview coming up, and I typed in polyimides in a patent search, and I found today there are 1,370 patents on polyimides.
And yours was the first.
And Brinker, well, on Wall Edwards and I had the first, And there are 73 patents on polybenzimidazoles, and Keith Brinker and I have the first. And there are 46 patents on polybenzoxazole, and Keith Brinker and I have the first. And that's recognized in the literature. Incidentally, there are 2,200 patents on polyamides. So there's a lot of patent work. Can I move on to another topic?
Oh, please do.
Okay. I had in the exploratory section, it varied over time, but probably 5 to 7 technical people reporting to me. And Art Anderson had the same number, roughly, over this period of time. And Anderson and I both reported to W.F. Gresham. I should say a little bit about how that operation was run. Frank tended to be a micromanager. He liked to know the details of what was going on. Initially, when I joined his group, we had to write a daily report, which the technical men objected to highly, but Frank insisted. Frank relented a little bit in the polychemicals department, so we went to a weekly report system, which the technical bench guy still objected to, but it was the job of Art and I to make it palatable, which I think we did reasonably. Although there are some objected more than others. But I think part of my job as a supervisor was to make it tolerable. There was an advantage in retrospect to the weekly report system. We would get together for a staff meeting with Gresham once a week, sit down and go through in great detail each of those weekly reports and discuss the successes and the failures. So we really had a intimate, steady look at the progress of research over that period of time. It was a lot of work, but it kept us sharp.
I'm sure it kept the bench chemist sharp too.
Exactly. Right. They didn't like it, but that's right. Anyway, we did have a very productive group of young chemists. And for the most part, these were people directly out of school who never had done anything in the polymer field, probably never wanted to. Because back in academia, polymers were gooey masses that were unknown and undecipherable and unwanted.
Chemists made a lot of them, but they
threw away
down the drain.
Right, exactly. By 1954. I had a man in my group by the name of N.G. Merkley. He'd been assigned a program. Actually, it was Anderson's idea. We were in the polyethylene business, and we knew technically, but not commercially, that there were better polyethylenes that could be made. In fact, I think Don Pease in Central Research had shown that the more linear polyethylene was a stiffer material. But it required impractical conditions to make it. Art Anderson had suggested that we might be able to stiffen up a polyethylene chain by putting in a ring structure, and suggested a candidate was norborin, which is
the bicyclic ring structure we get from cyclopentadiene ethylene has one double bond. The rationale behind Art's suggestion was that a lot of free radical polymerizations don't proceed because you can get the radical moving around to portions of the molecule where it prevents the chain polymerization process. And on the bicyclic ring structure of norbornene, you really can't get a free radical at a bridgehead position. Therefore, he said, let's try ethylene norbornene. And Merkling, in my group, was assigned that program. And he had tried many different experiments on trying to get a copolymer unsuccessfully. And I don't know the details as to how he came across an old patent. The reason I know enough of this still in my memory roughly 50 years later, we've been in a lot of patent litigation in regard to this work, so I had my mind refreshed agonizingly over the last 20 to 30 years. But Merkling found an old patent by Max Fisher, who was working for Battershire Allen Soda Fabric at the time, in which he made a polymer for methylene. And I think the unusual thing of the Max Fisher catalyst, it looked like a modified Friedel-Crafts catalyst for surface, because it was aluminum chloride, titanium chloride, and a metal. I think sodium, but I'm not absolutely sure of that. Anyway, Nick found that patent reference and decided to try the Max Fisher technology with ethylene norbornene, and made a very small amount of polymer. And not really enough to do much with. So I suggested to him that leave out the norbornene and just try ethylene, and he made another small amount of polymer, which intriguingly looked fairly stiff. In fact, I have a sample, that sample right here. You want to stop for a minute? Anyway, that shortly after that, Nick was able to make a small amount of polymer from propylene. And in fact, this part I do remember, because I took the very small amount of powder, heated it on a spatula, and pulled out a fiber, and said, well, we've got the very first polypropylene in the world. Well, that wasn't really true, but we thought it at the time. Well, it was an exciting time. We were able to make many new polymers we had no idea of or conceived of a few weeks before. And we invited people in from other departments who came into Gresham's office. We sat down and reviewed what we had discovered. And Anderson, I think, made a major contribution in that he conceived of the key portion of the catalyst was a reduced form of titanium. And that was a guiding direction for how to make a catalyst. And with that, we were able to make catalysts from many different other components of the periodic table. Soon there was enough interest in other departments that we would have a periodic meeting with chemists from fibers, film, elastomers particularly. And I don't know the total number of chemists assigned to those programs at the time, but we did have a substantial number of people at the experimental station working on that type of polymerization, which actually I coined the name for, coordination polymerization. And in fact, I got a little bit of heat about that at the first research review. We had conceived of the mechanism as to the pi electrons on a carbon-carbon double bond coordinating with the reduced titanium, and then it activated that molecule and swung around and formed a link to the titanium, letting another olefin double bond come in, get coordinated, activated, swing around, and another one and another, and so the propagation step. Up to that time, the only ways to make a polymer were through free radical or anionic or cationic polymerization. So at the first research review for the whole polychemicals department, and I said in my talk, we are going to offer you a new kind of polymerization called coordination polymerization. Not universally accepted, because I know that one of the research associates wrote a memo saying hogwash, basically. That's not true. It can't be a new kind of polymerization. But it was. Remarkably, other laboratories in the U.S. and Europe essentially made the same discovery at about the same time. We were shattered, of course, to find we were going to be in a multi-party interference on polyethylene and polypropylene and all the rest of these things. And that went on for a long time. We did get the Canadian composition matter patent on polypropylene. Not that it did the company any good, because polypropylene is now a commodity, multi-million pound a year plastic. The DuPont position, they carved out a specialty niche in the spun-bonded polyethylene business, but polyethylene, polypropylene are really commodity plastics these days, made by chiefly by companies that have a good base in the raw material position.
You alluded to the dispute over the patents that did, as far as the U.S. patent situation is concerned, did DuPont lose out on the patent situation for polypropylene?
Yes, they did. Right. Phillips Petroleum Company ended up with the composition matter on polypropylene.
Mm-hmm. Because their documentation was dated earlier?
I'm not sure of that. It could have been their filing date was earlier. I really don't know what the decision was based on. I do know that there was a lot of discussion about the quality of the records from Phillips Petroleum.
You mean good quality or deficient quality?
Our legal people told us they were skeptical of the quality of the Phillips records. And I can say something off the record about that later. I had a group of good people. I'd like to talk a little bit about those people.
Well, that would be very good.
Okay. Don Payne in my group P-A-Y-N-E, was a physical chemist, but he had he was very ingenious, and he took and separated polypropylene into an amorphous fraction and a highly crystalline fraction. And I think that was the first time we saw a highly crystalline polypropylene. One of the things we did with that material in film form, I know Herbie Lotario and I took it to the film department and had it two-way oriented in their equipment and said, boy, this stuff looks just like Mylar. And because it was tough and transparent, even as highly crystalline, it was still very transparent. Other people, there were so many. In fact, for an award I'm getting here later this spring, when I heard about it, I sat down and made a list of people I worked with. And I came up with 41 that I remember. And I don't have time to talk about all of them. But some of the good things we did. Rudy Dijon, I know, and I had a program on making ethylene SO2 copolymer. Up to that time, we'd only been able to make a one-to-one copolymer. And that was not a usable material. But Rudy and I found a way to reduce the amount of SO2 and made a very interesting copolymer of ethylene SO2. In fact, I wonder whatever happened to that, because we have a composition matter patent on it. And it should be an interesting polymer. Good way to get rid of some SO2 into a reasonable structure instead of putting it up in the environment.
But the SO2 units in the polymer and
yes.
As sulfone?
Yes, exactly. Right. And the key to it was to really restrict the availability of SO2 during the copolymerization process. Waller Gall and my group found a way to make good high molecular weight polyethylene glycol terephthalate by using pyrolytic dianhydride. Textile Fibers was very interested in that at one time. I don't know what happened to that. Don McCain and my group found a way to dimerize perfluoropropylene into a dimethyl cyclobutane, which was of interest for its boiling point at one time. I don't know whatever happened to that. Don Brebner in my group worked on polyimide composites. I wonder whatever happened to those. And I could go on. I'm going to skip now to 1958. The management decided in 1958 that the chemical side of the polychemicals department business had not been given enough attention, and they spun off a group in the research division to work on the chemicals business of the polychemicals department. So that was my separation from polymer chemistry for quite a long time. So we were given the objective of to try to come up with new chemicals for the chemicals business. And that takes a long time. I think I initiated this action, but I did the traveling, but I said, what chemicals are we throwing away right now? And I made a trip tour of our departments, first to Bell, then to Sabine, then Victoria. And at Bell, I found in the nylon intermediates business, particularly in the hexametalline diamine area, we were indeed burning and throwing away byproducts. The first one that I found about, or heard about, was hexametalline imine, which was a cyclic product from hexametalline diamine, a byproduct. And it was a very simple process to collect it from this distillation refining process, and we were able rapidly to commercialize that hexametalline product. At the other end of the refining chain,
do you have a market for it?
Yes, right. And I looked up hexametalline and found there were a bunch of patents on it too. So it's amazing what you can do on the internet these days, right from my home computer here. There were bottoms from the hexametalline diamine refining train, and this was a higher molecular weight amine product, which just as such, without any improvement, we were able to find a market for it, and we called it first Bell Diamine Heel, and it was called Amine 248 B for 2, and D for 4, and 8 for Heel. And we found a market for that in asphalt compositions and so on. The biggest byproduct stream was NVR, the non-volatile residue from the adipic acid process, which had a lot of hydroxycaprolic acid in it. We did have a program for a while trying to make ester plasticizers for polyvinyl chloride, but then never got off the ground. I think today the adipic acid process has been refined enough so they don't make nearly as much byproduct. But they still make, I think there was a stage in the refining process where they made a mixture of succinic butyric and adipic acids, which I think got commercialized as esters of those. So I think there is some market for that. And then about 1959, maybe, top management decided to amalgamate in another department the chemicals business, and so a group of us from Polychemicals Chemicals got amalgamated with Griselli department. And culturally, that was a tough transition for a lot of us. It was an entirely different way to do research, and fortunately for me, I had another promotion to become manager of development and service at Chestnut Run for that department, where I went in 1960 or 61. And I had a long career there till 1974. It was revealing in this way. There's an awful lot of work
that has to be done to take an invention from the bench through development stage to market, to get it accepted in the marketplace. It takes a long time. And we did this very successfully with azo-bis-isobutyl-nitrile, which is now known as VASO. It was made in a batch process just for internal use at the Parkersburg plant. Had a chemist assigned, Bill Langsdorff, to look at that process, and we markedly improved it. We got the plant to accept it. We had enough product for development work. Had a great development guy, Norm Rockwell, who basically single-handed took that to our districts. Now, one of the problems with taking a product like that into the established chemicals sales organization is nobody understands the technology. And you can't easily train a salesman to handle that. So it is a very difficult transition. I'm sure it occurs with other products too. I look back on my administrative time at Chestnut Run as a lab director as satisfying but not rewarding. Too many headaches, personnel problems. I did work with some very good people, and it gave me a better appreciation for the whole aspect of the chemicals business, but there was something lacking. So along about 1973, I was offered the chance to go back to research as
history interview with Dr. Maxwell Robinson on January 24, 2001. Dr. Robinson, you were just commenting about your administrative work at Chestnut Run, and you were returning to Wilmington, I believe.
Yeah, well, Chestnut Run is just outside of Wilmington,
okay.
So it's within the environment. Got back to the experimental station as a research associate in a department, I think it was called Chemicals, Dyes, and Pigments, but I really, there have been several other amalgamations of the DuPont businesses. I've really been in five departments, but I've been here in Wilmington all the time.
As a research fellow, did you have administrative duties, or were you back full-time as a researcher?
I went there as a research associate, and shortly after I'd been there a while, was made a research fellow. The only administrative duty I had an excellent laboratory technician, Larry Dorsey. In fact, I should say something about lab technicians anyway. Way back in my beginning with DuPont, I had an excellent lab technician, Pat DeCampley, who was a gem. Anyway, Larry Dorsky, who'd been a lab technician for a long time, very dependable, good experimentalist, and Larry and I hit it really off well together. There have been several changes, I think, in the titles, but at the time,
when I was a research fellow, it was a top technical assigned title. And there was another man who there at the same trip, Ralph Eiler, who was a research fellow. Just as a coincidence, Ralph Eiler had passed through the same Canadian Industries Laboratory at Belle Isle that I had 10 years later. So we both end up in the same building at the DuPont Experimental Station years later, both as research fellows. One advantage of the research fellow category is you really get a higher opportunity to work on what you want to do. And the Palmer business that we were in that department was the the soft segment for Lycra. And it was a polymer made by polymerization of tetrahydrofuran. And this looked like an area where some of my polymer background could be of value. And so I gravitated to work in that field.
Okay.
Really enjoyed getting back to the bench and looking at what we could do to enhance our role in the soft segment portion of the Lycra business.
What do you mean by soft segment?
Okay. The Lycra, and other polymers derived in the same general nature, usually are made from several different components. For example, polyurethane technology requires a diisocyanate along with a short chain glycol like butadiol to make a hard segment. The ring structure is joined by a very short segment, but then they need a flexible long chain, usually a Marshall weight 1,000 to 5,000, which gives you the soft segment portion of this polymer. Controlling those three components is how you change the properties, and that shows up today in things like the scooter wheels for the kid scooters. Anyway, back to the specific needs for Lycra. At that time, there was concerns about free radical stability to the resulting polymer, hydrolytic stability, and so we and processability. We found that an ethylene oxide THF copolymer would give a lot lower viscosity to the melt stage for spinning and could result in a lot higher productivity for the established spinning plants. And so there was quite a bit of interest at Waynesboro in taking that copolymer and trying to improve their productivity with it. One of the early on problems we found with that copolymer is that it had a byproduct component with a cyclic ether structure. In fact, I did the initial laboratory work showing that these were many different ring sizes having different ethylene oxide to THF compositions. And we did a lot of work to control that undesired amount of byproducts in that polymer. I know it was scaled up to make drum size quantities, but by the time I retired, I don't know just what the eventual decisions were made on that polymer. I made many different variants to the soft segment structure and probably have at least 10 or 15 patents on sulfur modified, carbon 8 modified, blend modified, many different modifications of that PTMEG backbone structure. I don't know where that stands today, but if there are needs for the market, I think it would be good to go back and review the many possibilities that I found for coming up with variants to the initial polymer. So I had a great time and very rewarding experience. So I retired at the end of 1981.
In terms of your age, that was a little early, wasn't it?
Yes.
Were the circumstances that you chose to enjoy the good life, or DuPont was having cutbacks, or what?
Well, yes, I would say there there was an atmosphere of cutback time in the DuPont company right then, and Jay Coetzee at Indiana University had offered me a chance to go there as a visiting scientist, which I did.
Had he been a consultant at DuPont, and that's the way you became acquainted?
Yes, right. And Jay and I had a great relationship. He's a dynamic, one of our best consultants, I felt. Very intelligent, and so I went out to Indiana University and spent a semester there in his lab and produced, I think, a very important work on alpha, omega, perfluorodicarboxylic acids, which we published and patented. I think that showed for the first time that all Teflon has dicarboxylic acid end groups. What has happened since then has been disappointing. Nobody has picked up on that technical revelation. I know some things I would do if I was back in the lab. I'd love to get in there and stew around a little bit. I could show some good things that could be done with that technology.
And Professor Cokie didn't continue it, huh?
No, he did not. Shortly after I left, got a big grant from University of Houston, and the grant process in academia takes a lot of time and energy away from more productive things. This was going to relieve him from ever having to apply for grants again. I think that was the primary reason he went.
Well, you had a full and productive career at DuPont and retired at age 61.
Yes.
And as you look back on it, you have alluded a few times to the fact that you achieved a patent position in certain work that you did, but you didn't really know what had happened with it afterward.
Yeah.
As a bench chemist producing this patentable work, did you feel content or frustrated at the fact that the company decision was not to commercialize this patented work, or what?
There's always some frustration, but I realize now, having been through the development and technical sales thing, that a lot of other things have to fit together to make a commercial success. It's not just that it's a big invention, because a lot of other things that have to fall into place to make a commercial success. It is discouraging that we haven't found an easier way to capitalize on significant inventions. And I know the DuPont Company has tried a number of what appeared to be innovative ways of doing this. They had task force, they've had the development department set up, venture organizations, but none of those really solved the process of making the pathway from discovery to commercial reality an easy thing to do. It's a tricky procedure. I'm reminded a little bit about the Tyvek story. I haven't told you about the Tyvek story.
No, you haven't. Okay. Please do.
Okay. Back in the early days of high-density polyethylene, in the mid-50s, the responsibility for this polyethylene was transferred to Dan Strange's group in the polychemicals department, from Gresham's group to Dan Strange's group. And they had put up a small autoclave to make larger quantities for evaluation purposes. Someone from Textile Fibers came to Dan Strain and said they would love to have a sample of this polymer for their own evaluation as a fiber. And Strain said, gosh, we don't have enough for our own use. And so was reluctant to give out any samples. But a man in Strain's group
by the name of Dick Jones, who was working on the autoclave. His wife worked in Textile Fibers Department. And Fibers Management, or supervision up there, said, surely your husband can release a small sample for us to look at. And Dick happened to grab from the letdown chamber of the autoclave the last portion of product that had come through, which is the solvent had evaporated. It had made a sponge-like mass of fibers. And he just grabbed that and put it in his lunchbox, took it home, gave it to his wife. She took it into work. And pretty soon, Textile Fibers Management descended on either McGrew or Bakley and said, why haven't you told us about this wonderful new invention of fibers you have? And of course, McGrew or Bakley didn't know anything about it. And that was the serendipity involved there. Okay. But of course, then what do you do with this? This brand new mass of spun-bond fibers. And it's just been amazing the markets that have developed up for such a composition.
Was the autoclave operator reprimanded for
I don't know.
For disobeying the protocol?
He may have even gotten a bonus. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, that sounds like a story to encourage DuPont and other companies to make sure that both spouses are employed rather than resisting it.
Yeah. Well, thinking back to the records, I was in at the experimental station in conjunction with this interview and a forthcoming award to go through some of my early notebooks, and found to my chagrin that a lot of the memos I had written to file have no longer exist and have been destroyed, I think primarily for legal matters, procedures, or concerns, so that
the memos contained potentially unfavorable disclosures.
I don't think they did. I wrote. We had periodic meetings on coordination polymerization. I would say at least once a month for many months, between the departments involved. I think I usually wrote up a memo to file on the highlights of those meetings. Well, all that's gone. And I think that would be a great record to have available. I do have one good record I found in the notebook, which is I kept over the years idea notebooks, and I found a couple of these that I was able to get out of records that are, it's almost like a diary of the people I talked to and the suggestions that were made, and that's as close to a diary of the times as 55 and 56 that probably is still available.
It sounds like a valuable bit of archival material. I hope it doesn't get lost.
Yes, right. Well, I plan to bring that to somebody's attention, because I don't think there's a comparable record in view of the destruction of files that are around. And I,
I'd love to go back and do some of the lab work on some of those suggestions, which still look pretty good to me. One other event here, that this is sort of interesting here. I went through my files and found this is a group of chemists at the station who were involved in the polyethylene adventure.
Each making a different contribution to the success of the project.
Uh-huh, right. Another...
Well, do you have any comment you would like to make for the record about your assessment, looking back on your career, the assessment of the DuPont organization approach to doing chemistry and production? I mean, you moved around through several departments with promotions as you went, and eventually returned as a research associate, research fellow, to doing what you had started off doing in the kind of work. Do you think that that approach to the organization of chemists is the most fruitful approach you can imagine, or could you make suggestions for change and improvement in the organizational structure?
Well, just a few comments. I think there are many situations where people get promoted into a level that they don't belong or are comfortable in. And that's unfortunate. I think there's, in my own case, I got separated from a mass of that initial discovery time, and went off on another road. Actually, the road I traveled was fine. I mean, I think the DuPont company treated me very well. But there was a lack of continuity. I mean, I would have liked to have kept in touch, but I was in another area, which is disappointing. So there's a little bit of lack of fulfillment in that area. I don't think there's any easy answer. I know that, as I mentioned, the DuPont Company has tried many different approaches to research and new product development. There's no one guaranteed yellow brick road that's going to make it the way to always do it. And it's going to vary depending on the time and the invention and the situation.
Well, your career was one that certainly inspired your co-workers, inspired them to even in that lengthy rhyming scheme to comment on your career at the time of your retirement. Among the papers I received was a copy of the rhyming summary of your career, which an entertaining way to look back on it. You made reference a couple of times to a forthcoming award that you are to receive this spring. Would you tell me something about that and what brings it about at this time in your retirement? You're in your 20th year of retirement.
Right, almost. Right. The award is the Lavoisier Medal Award for technical achievement. And
is this awarded by the DuPont Company?
Awarded by the DuPont Company.
As an annual award?
Annual award started in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some of my co-workers, like Gresham, Eleuterio, and Anderson, have been previously awardees.
Are all of the previous awardees also retirees at the time that they get the reward?
I don't think so, but it's a large number of people who, some of which, or who have passed on. So it goes way back to Stein and Greenwald and early management people who were in charge of DuPont research direction.
What is the description of the basis for the Lavoisier Award?
Technical accomplishment. I really feel honored. In fact, I didn't do it all by myself. I feel my teachers, my professors, my associates should be getting a piece of this at the same time. So I can't stress enough how fortunate I've been coming from some pretty humble beginnings that I've been able to get to this particular spot.
What does the Lavoisier Award consist of? You mentioned a medal. Is there anything other than the medal?
I've been to several of the annual ceremonies, and they usually present a small videotape interview of the person getting the award with a short overview of his career, his or her career. There's been at least one female, I think. A short speech, and there's also a site at the experimental station where there is a plaque unveiled. I think it is mostly recognition of technical accomplishment and of significance to the DuPont Company.
Is the award event held on site at the DuPont Company, or is
it's held downtown in the Playhouse.
I see.
And we can invite family and friends there. So.
Dr. Robinson, I'm sure that the Lavoisier Medal ceremony will be a gratifying and impressive occasion in the spring.
Looking forward to it.
What is the date for that?
It's going to be April the 26th here in Wilmington.
Good. According to some biographical notes I have seen, you have for quite a number of years been a participant in the Academy of Lifelong Learning under the auspices of the University of Delaware.
Yes.
Tell us something about that.
Back in the early 1980s, a small core group of retired people in Wilmington got together and said we ought to make some use of the talent of retired people in this year area. And they, under the sponsorship of the University of Delaware, formed a small group, were able to get facilities in a building, and started in offering a small variety of courses. It's now grown from that small group to approximately 2,000 members, and we have about 140 volunteer instructors covering everything from art, music, language, history, social studies, and more recently, computer programs. That's been for me particularly a great chance to catch up a little bit on the fine arts side of academia. One of the problems in my scientific career is there was such a heavy emphasis on technology that I didn't take any philosophy or any significant history or related type topics.
You mentioned that you have about 1,000 people involved here.
2,000.
Is there any particular formality of getting involved in the Academy of Lifelong Learning, or is it just a kind of come and go according to the offerings each term?
We have a registration process in January. Classes will start first week in February, go on for the same semester schedule as at the university. There's a registration fee for each semester. Instructors pay essentially the same fee, but we have such a multitude of talent in the retired community here that we're very fortunate in people who are enjoying getting together and keeping up with the world.
You indicated earlier that you not only take courses, but you're also a volunteer instructor. What courses or subject matter are you teaching?
I've been teaching genealogy for the past 10 years. I started initially I took on the job of tracing my ancestors primarily for my children. Gene and I, as immigrants to this country, have a more tenuous hold on the memories of the homeland. And I felt it would be worthwhile to let our children know some of what we can find out about our roots, the people and the times. And fortunately, there are records available today, and it's becoming increasingly more available on the internet, that allows one to go back dramatically in time to find out about these people who were our ancestors. So I found it not a task, but a very rewarding activity. I've generated four books, actually one on my Robinson family, one on my mother's side, the Lewises of Prince Edward Island, and just recently one on my wife's side, the Andersons and Mackays of Fife, Scotland. Well, it's been a lot of work, but a tremendous amount of satisfaction.
I'm sure your children welcome this insight into their past.
We've had a tremendous response. They can't get over really how well our family has kept in touch over the years. In fact, we've had since the 80s, four family reunions. We now get together with about 65 people from Canada and here. Been a challenging but rewarding activity for retirement.
Well, that's a personal avocation that you have brought into the teaching arena through the Academy of Lifelong Learning. Is there anything else that you've been teaching in the program?
Well, as a spinoff, I give a couple lectures a semester on how to do genealogy on the internet, which has changed, of course, and is changing every year. It's amazing what's available.
What courses are you primarily interested in taking in the academy? Since you list that on your curriculum vitae.
I've taken some wonderful courses. The Life of George Washington. The man who gave this lecture is one of the best lectures I've ever heard in my whole life. I've taken...
Was he a professional historian, or was he like you are with genealogy, that he had developed an interest in it?
He's a retired technical person who's taken up history as his challenge. The other great courses are a series of medical lectures which go on each semester. They take usually a known expert in a field, and we would have, say, 150 to 200 attending those lectures once a week. Great variety of challenges.
You made reference in connection with your genealogical interest to your family. Tell me something about your family. You have, of course, made reference to your wife, Jean, in the early discussion about your immigration to this country. Tell me something else about the family.
I'd love to talk about my family. I've generated, this past year, an album for each of our children. I started with our number two son, who was going to be 50 in the year 2000. I said, it'd be a great 50th birthday present. And Gene, of course, said, well, if you're going to do it for Rick, you'll have to do it for the other three. So I have.
So you have four children.
I have four children, and I've generated a memory book covering their life to the present. And in the centerpiece of this book, I have a page with a condensed write-up on their grandparents. And, for example, let me just say a little bit about my parents.
Do.
And
give us their names, too.
Yeah, I have another opposite page here on Gene's parents, but let me just focus on my dad and mother. Charles Burnham Robinson, 1892 to 1970. And Dora Fanny Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, 1892 to 1893, both born in Kings County, Nova Scotia, married the 15th of August 1919, settled first in Lakeville, Kings County, where they ran the general store,
then moved to a farm, and finally to Kemptville, where he established a thriving car business. Charles Burnham Robinson was always known as Barney, after his middle name. He was working in his uncle's store in Lakeville when he enlisted in the Royal Canadian Army in 1915, and was part of the 85th Battalion, which is a Scottish Highland regiment with kilts. Then he was in the 219th Division of that during the war and served overseas for the entire war, was wounded twice. After discharge in 1919, he married Dora Lewis and took over the Lakeville store. He eventually opened his own car business. His cheerful and outgoing manner made him a popular businessman. He was a generous man, a soft touch for many of those in need. He was an outdoors man and loved hunting and fishing with his dogs. A little bit about my mother. Dora was part of a strong Baptist heritage. Her early life as a teacher in rural schools and the Kemptville School set the stage for a lifelong interest in education. She was able to attend her normal school 70th class reunion. Her many activities included church, choir, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and the Order of the Eastern Star, that's Masonic. One of her special interests was drama. She organized and produced amateur plays. She was a strong admirer of the British royal family and flew the British flag long after Canada had its own flag. In her time, there was a significant awareness of class distinction. That was a legacy of sorts from the British. Dora moved with the upper class in town. Her good friend Ethel Kinsman was the mayor. She loved driving her car, transporting friends to events. Even in later years, in her 80s, she was teaching children to read. Today we call it mentoring. Okay, that's a taste in this book I've tried to give for our kids. And it covers their activities, but also relatives and families and friends. So I've had a great time doing that.
I bet so, and it's a delightful gift for your children.
I'll be right back. I actually went to work on a farm on an island off the coast of Maine when he was a teenager. So,
this is your father?
Just my father.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, in contrast, my mother actually, for those times, she was one of four children, and two boys and two girls, and both of the girls had it 1 year in college at Acadia University, which is remarkable for those times. And I'm sure that's part of the reason that they were always pushing me for more education. In fact, I should tell you one story which I didn't hear about till years later. When I graduated from high school, the bank manager came to my parents and said, "We'd like to offer Max a job in the bank." And this was in the height of the Depression, and we had no money. In fact, I remember putting cardboard in my shoes so the soles were worn out. So I would have jumped at that job, but they wouldn't. They said to the bank manager, "No, you're not going to. We want him to go to school." So that was a critical point.
Did you have any siblings?
Yeah, I had a sister. Yeah, and she also went to Acadia University a couple of years after I did, and she ended up until she got married as secretary to the president of the university. So she was. Just a little, that's a critical stage of my life, and my parents, of course,
made the right decision for me.
I had a whole bunch of jobs to earn a lot of money. I mowed lawns, I caddied at the golf course, as I got into college, I was a bellhop in the Canadian Pacific Railway System, which was a great summer job. Got paid 33 1/3 cents a day. But I got room and board and tips. I could save roughly $200 for working the summer, and then tuition was $500, so that was a big hunk towards tuition. One of the things I did, which is a little unusual, even though those were four-star hotels, and people who came had a lot of money, they paid $100 a day, which was ridiculous in those days. Me getting 33 1/3 cents a day. But the hotels didn't have radios. I'd gone to the World's Fair in New York and stopped over in Boston on the way back and went to a pawn shop and picked up a radio, typewriter, and suitcase for $35. And I had that radio with me, and during the summer I would rent my radio out for $1 a night in the hotel. Well, that radio helped me through college.
Your radio is worth more than your work.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, well, the guests would come in the hotel and ask the clerk, well, there's no radio in the room. Well, one of the bellhops has a radio. Anyway, well, this is the book I put together on my, just finished that class, and I did all of that on my computer. Downloaded those tartans off of the internet, and of course, there's great software programs now for genealogy.
Impressive.
Yeah.
Well, tell me something about your four children. What are they doing?
All right, four children. All right, the oldest boy, Ken, worked for the DuPont Company, the textile fibers department, and ended up in the composites area of the textile fibers business, and they sold that portion of the business to another company. And Ken was given the opportunity of early retirement at the time and took it. So he's 54 and retired. He spends, he's an outdoors. He spends all of his time on nature trails. He's kayaking and biking and maintaining the park trails. So that's his life is outdoors, and that's what he's doing. He was married, divorced, has two daughters who live in this area. So we have grandchildren close by. Number two son, Rick, became 50 this year. He's married, lives in Richmond. He's a teacher. He's right where he ought to be. The kids love him. He's teaches social studies, and he's a PE teacher.
Yeah, high school.
He's in middle school for teaching, but he does soccer, girls and boys, for both middle and high school. So, and he's got a wonderful relationship with the kids. The girls' mothers, particularly, will call and say, "What can I do to get Susie on the soccer team? What can we train?" Anyway, but he says it's almost out of hand as far as the prestige thing of getting on the soccer team.
Anyway, Rick is a wonderful guy. He's he's very much like his grandfather. Very personable. He's got friends everywhere and who maintain contact with him. His best friend's out in Denver, and they talk together once a week. So Rick is sentimental, but a wonderful kid. Third child is Barbara, and she is a gem. Well, she's, as I said, in assembling these pictorial reminders of years past, has been a chance to vicariously relive some of those moments and watch with wonder as you grew to the wonderful, fun-loving, caring woman, wife, and mother you are. And she is. We couldn't have asked for a more wonderful daughter. She's a teacher. she loves to teach, but she backed out of teaching while her two boys were young and stayed out of teaching for quite a while till the boys got into high school. Well, maybe late junior high. One of those boys is in college right now at Elon, North Carolina. The other boy's in high school. But Barbara is a caring, wonderful daughter. She's a gem. Number four son, John, is the youngest, and he's 42, in Richmond. He took business in college and went to work for a big paper company, worked there for quite a while, and decided he could do better in his own business. He's in financial planning. He's doing very well. He's got a wife and three kids. And, he's a Boy Scout leader. He's active in the Baptist Church. He's which my mother would love. We go to a Presbyterian church here. So we've been really blessed with our kids, and we've got seven grandchildren. Mm-hmm. So,
and two sons ended up in the same city in Richmond.
Two sons. Well, yeah, probably because of Rick. He was a bachelor for a while, and he had a house. And, our neighbor's boy, Rick, says, come, you can find a job in Britain. Come and live free in my house. But Ricky's the sort of kid, everything's a game. He would make a game out of who's going to wash the dishes. And Charlie would say, from the kid next door, says, I always end up washing the dishes. Anyway, then our son, our youngest son, went into Richmond after college and got a job down there, so, yeah.
Well, it's been a very interesting account of your life and times. Do you think of anything you would like to add to make sure the record is complete at this point? Is there anything you left out?
Well, I'm sure there's things I left out.
As you look back now from the perspective of essentially 20 years in retirement, and see from the record that during portions of that 20 years you've been, in a sense, called back into service by DuPont to be a witness in patent infringement cases, have gotten accolades from the continuing employees, supervisors at DuPont, for the efficacy of your witness testimony in those cases. But as you look back on your career, what, if any, one thing you would pick out as being most satisfying to you?
It's hard to select
certainly
one thing. But now the joy of discovery is hard to match. That's terrific. But one of the things, and in late retirement, which I have, well, really secretly enjoyed, is people who I haven't seen for a long time will come and say to me, "You were my mentor." I didn't mean to be their mentor. And I guess I didn't realize it at the time, but I've had people come and say the reason I stayed with the DuPont company is because of you. You can't buy that sort of
no
stuff. One thing, Jim, I'd like to bring to your attention, if you haven't seen it, is this book, which I only just recently got in hand, but I'd heard about it, but I have not had a chance to read.
Science and Corporate Strategy.
It really covers the DuPont Company up till 1980. I have not had a chance to digest this book, but it is a revelation to me about some of the management background decisions on corporate planning, and some successful and some not so successful.
Was this a book commissioned by DuPont, or written by a person who was totally outside the company and just got interested in it?
They're commissioned by DuPont, and the two authors are David Hounshell, H-O-U-N-S-H-E-L-L, John Kenley Smith, covers DuPont R&D period of time 1902-1980.
Do you appear in the book?
I do, yes. If you look in the index, it says, and they have, interestingly here, my full name, Ivan Maxwell Robinson. Page, we'll look it up. It covers primarily the period in Gresham's group, 492-493. I'm just going to read one little section of it.
Okay.
If it's appropriate. Okay. I had mentioned in our earlier discussion this morning, Jim, that remarkably the discovery of coordination polymerization occurred in so many places at the same time. And here they're discussing the background. In September 1954, DuPont learned that Carl Ziegler, director of the Max Planck Institute for Coal Research in Mulheim, West Germany, had discovered catalysts similar to those of DuPont and was going to offer to discuss for a fee, $50,000, just what he had done. Okay.
And what was the year that that DuPont had, or you and DuPont had developed the coordination catalyst?
1954.
You did it in 54, and Ziegler did it in 54 also.
Right. Well, I'm not sure, exactly sure of the date. Actually, the intriguing thing is Ziegler and Natta in Italy, who was that, I had learned about the catalysis from Ziegler, but went on to investigate propylene polymerization. I'm not going to go into a lot of this detail, but here in the book it says that the DuPont's chemist had a right to feel disappointed, if not somewhat bitter, because they had made the same discovery in that urn, and that had earned someone else fame and fortune, because Ziegler and Natta got the Nobel Prize.
Right.
In any event, the polychem chemists led by Gresham, Anderson, and Robinson had made an outstanding contribution of Nobel Prize caliber, but the extremely competitive nature of polymer R&D prevented them or DuPont from receiving.
Of Dr. Maxwell Robinson on January 24, 2001. Okay.
Ziegler and Natta published their early findings, and even I think in Nature magazine they published some of the intriguing leads without adequately defining just what their catalyst system was, which is unheard of for those times, and got the publicity. And understandably, DuPont, as any other corporation, was reluctant to let us disclose what we had done. And that was true on the polyimide story, too. A lot of people later published, and we did not. So, and publication policy is a dilemma for big corporations. I don't think there's any easy answer. But for the chemists, there's of course a carryover from the academia tradition, publish or perish, which still prevails.
Yeah.
So when you come from university to business, there's an additional parameter of commercial aspects of and the problems of disclosure.
Did you sense that there had been a shift in the corporate attitude toward disclosure through publications that enable Pedersen to become known for his Crown Ether work at DuPont and receive the Nobel Prize for that? That was some years after your work on the coordination polymerization.
I really don't know, but I do know there was a tremendous difference in the culture of DuPont departments. Some departments were much more willing for the researchers to publish their work than other departments. And it depends on the management of that department. I had, along with Warren Brain, generated three papers for publication on polyimides, which are in this stack of documents here, and our management would not release that information. But we didn't get publicity.
Mm-hmm.
But at least...
maybe it was an indication that your management sensed more profit potential out of the work you were doing than some other managements did.
Why take a chance? Yeah, it is chance.
What else do you want to have included
the other,
here?
The other thing I just wanted to point out is at the latter stages in my career as a research associate,
The top management, whenever a patent issue in my name, would send a cover letter acknowledging their hopes that this continued exploratory and patent work would be a benefit to their business. And so basically, here's one from my general manager, E.P. Blanchard, Doc Blanchard, saying congratulations for contribution to the well-being of the department. We're much appreciated. That's pretty unusual. That didn't go on early on in my career, but near the end of career, management was paying attention to acknowledging some of the technical contributions.
What else do we need to add? Think of anything? One intriguing aspect I'll ask here, it really has nothing to do with your career, but one of the documents you showed me early on, I think it was from your high school days, listing the classmates and so forth, that had your name as Maxwell Ivan Robinson, and yet now it's Ivan Maxwell Robinson. Was that, I presume, just an error at the high school level rather than you're deliberately inverting your name? You were known as Max all the time.
I was known as Max, and I probably just assumed my first name was Maxwell.
I see.
Although, actually, I have one of my university diplomas. It says Maxwell Ivan Robinson, too. So. Anyway, it's always been a problem because this one is Dr. Ivan M. Robinson, and so... it's not a big problem, but...
Your family always called you Matt.
They always did.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
Well, thank you very much for this lengthy and detailed account of your DuPont career. I'm certain that it will become a valuable part of the archives at the Chemical Heritage Foundation.
Thank you, Jim. I've enjoyed the morning. So it's a nice reviewing all this history.